Wednesday, August 9th, 2023. You are listening to the Daily Dose Sports Podcast, and I am your host, Clint Daly, coming to you from Mile High City here in Denver, Colorado. And we are back for another week of talking sports with a dose of common sense. Hey, happy Wednesday to you. Hope your week is going well. You are now reaching that halfway point through another week. That's always a good thing when we can get to another weekend. Hope your week is going well. Hope you, your family, your friends, everyone in your world is staying strong and staying healthy right now. And hey, we are now in August, and we now actually have some preseason football going. That is at least encouraging, because July and August, hey, I'm not going to lie, they're pretty tough months. There's not a whole lot to watch. Everything is in repeats. Now we're starting to inch closer to that football season. But I got to ask you, did you watch any of that Hall of Fame game last Thursday night? A little tough to watch. The Cleveland Browns beat the New York Jets 21-16 in what was mostly, well, a pretty hideous game. It was brutal. And I watched a decent portion of it, and it went exactly as I thought it would and as I predicted that it would last week here on The Dose. I mean, we had bad football. We didn't have many starters. We didn't get a weather delay, but we did get a power outage. So basically the same thing, right? Except that I just kind of figured Jets quarterback Aaron Rodgers wanted to drop more acid in the dark, so that wasn't really that unexpected either. One kind of rough moment that I think we have to discuss, we've got to talk about a little bit. Hall of Fame inductee pass rusher DeMarcus Ware actually performed the national anthem prior to the game. Now, it wasn't like the guy can't sing. He can. But one, his mic was very, very low, so he was real quiet. And then two, he stretched what should be around a 90-second song into about 15 minutes. That was kind of rough. But I guess he had dedicated that performance to his former teammate, the late wide receiver Demaryius Thomas. So I'm going to cut him a little bit of slack. Besides, it was still better than Fergie's national anthem a few years ago. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light? But I think the one surprise that I didn't see coming from that mess of a game last week was the overreaction by fans and the sports media world, as though that game mattered in any way whatsoever. That was really, really surprising to me. I didn't expect that. If you missed it, there are a number of people in the sports media world who are trying to spin that Jets backup quarterback Zach Wilson might be back. I don't know how that works. He was never there to begin with. And he could even be a better option at quarterback for the Jets than acid-dropping Aaron Rodgers. They're basing this on him going 3-for-5 for 65 yards. He did have a touchdown against what was basically like the Browns, I don't know, 7th or 8th string defense. Are we really supposed to believe anything we saw in this awful game? Is that how far we've fallen? Are we going to believe what we saw in a meaningless first preseason game? Come on. Next thing, the sports media world will be telling me to watch some social media clown box like a former MMA guy that obviously has significant CTE. And that is going to be the greatest thing coming out of the world of boxing. That's like the best the world of boxing has to offer. Who would believe that? I mean, no one. No one would actually be dumb enough to buy a fight like that, right? You'd have to be a complete imbecile. Yeah. Hey, before we jump in today, just want to remind you, be sure you're stopping by DailyDoseSports.com, where we have new articles going up every week. While here at The Dose on the podcast, we talk about a number of items. Usually on the Daily Dose website, we do write articles that might have a little more local flavor, although they could be about anything. But we also have links to the podcast over there. We have links to the video. We have links to Daily Dose gear. If you need a new t-shirt, sweatshirt, hoodie, be sure you stop by DailyDoseSports.com every single week and pick up exactly what it is that you need. Hey, today on the show, we are continuing to get you ready for the coming football season. And today, we're going to be looking at which teams are going to have the most difficult path to success. And here's something else to think about. Which college football program has been the most successful, at least recently? Our Daily Dose Top 5 might surprise you a little bit, but we do have a number of things in the sports news world that we need to talk about, so let's go ahead and jump into that. Well, kids, Team USA was the heavy favorite heading into the 2023 FIFA World Cup down in Australia this year. And so, Team USA has spent the last year or so complaining about their salaries, complaining about how misogynistic the United States is. And then they went down under and promptly pooped their self-righteous pants and got sent home from the tournament earlier than they ever have in the history of the World Cup. You know, Team USA, they couldn't score all tournament. And they couldn't finish when they had to in this tournament. And in the elimination round of 16, yeah, it was exactly the same thing on Sunday. They just couldn't execute when it mattered the most. Early Sunday morning, I think it started at like 3 a.m. or something, at least here Denver time, the U.S. played Sweden. And after two halves of scoreless soccer, during which the U.S. had a number of opportunities to score, they once again failed to score. They couldn't find the back of the net. They were always just a step off, always just missing by just a skosh. So the United States went to extra time for the fourth time, I might add, in World Cup history. No one scored in the extra time. And so the game went to penalty kicks. Okay, well, go win this thing. After taking a 3-2 lead in the best of five shootout, the United States managed to choke their final two kicks. And Sweden scored their final two kicks to now go to a one-kick playoff. So after both teams scored on their first kick, the U.S. completely missed the goal on their second kick. And Sweden scored a goal that was actually so close, they had to go to video review to see if it had crossed the line. It had. And we saw the women's U.S. team earliest exit ever in World Cup history. And you know, you may hear some things from the sports media world, especially from, you know, the worldwide leader in sports, because they're trying to get people to watch women's sports. And you may hear them say things like, hey, this is a good young team. This may be good for them. They're going to be primed for the Olympics in a couple of years. They're going to be ready for the next World Cup. And maybe that's all true. I don't know. But make no mistake, this was an absolute choke job by a team that had kind of become selfish and had become divisive. I mean, veteran Megan Rapinoe announced prior to the cup that she was going to retire afterward. But why? Why make it about you? Why do you have to even announce that? You don't have to put added pressure on you and your team. By the way, she of course missed one of those penalty kicks and missed the goal completely when she did. But again, and I said this back when Mike Krzyzewski did this with Duke, why do you make it about yourself? Why do you have to bring that extra pressure? Why do you have to put that on your team? There was no reason for it. Why not just go play and kind of see what happens and you can make that announcement later? But this is where our women's team is right now. A lot of personal agendas. A lot of talking politics instead of apparently practicing penalty kicks. And now this team has a number of questions about other members that also might retire. Julie Ertz says she's done. Goalie Alyssa Naher is in her late 30s. Alex Morgan is now 34. The coaching staff was completely non-existent. We didn't see adjustments. We didn't see improvements. We never saw them. Okay, well, they're getting better every game. No, it kind of seemed like they regressed the entire game. Make no mistake, Team USA absolutely choked in this World Cup. No discredit to Sweden, and especially that goalie who was incredible. But this was an all-time choke job by the United States, and they deserve all the criticism that they are going to get. Of course, one of the biggest stories coming out in all of sports over the past week has been the massive realignment that we are seeing in college sports. After Colorado announced they were bolting the Pac-12 last week because the Pac-12 still hadn't finalized a media deal of any kind, we then saw Oregon and Washington announcing that they are leaving the Pac-12 and jumping to the Big Ten already next year. It wasn't over, because then Arizona, Arizona State, and the University of Utah all announced that they will leave the Pac-12 and they will join the Big 12 with Colorado. So as of right now, and again, right now it feels like this could change any second, but here is how the conferences are going to look next season. The ACC will still have 14 teams, they say. And the reason I add that little caveat is the fact that they are saying both Clemson and Florida State would like to leave the ACC and join either the SEC or the Big Ten. Now, if that happens, what's going to happen to the ACC? Because I could easily see it going the same way as the Pac-12 and just dissolving. And what we're getting down to is two or three super conferences. That would be very, very interesting. But I want to keep an eye on the ACC, because if Clemson or Florida State do leave, that is going to start another house of cards that is going to start falling. We'll see what happens there. The Big 12 is scheduled to have 16 schools right now. But remember that the conference added BYU, Cincinnati, Houston, and Central Florida, but that Oklahoma and Texas will be leaving next year. Then they pick up Arizona, Arizona State, Colorado, and Utah for 2024. So that will be a 16-school conference. Big 12 is going to be pretty interesting. The Big 10 is slated to have 18 teams next year, with Oregon, UCLA, USC, and Washington coming aboard. The SEC will have 16 teams next year, with Oklahoma and Texas joining. And then we have the Pac-12, which currently has just 4 teams remaining, with Cal, Oregon State, Stanford, and Washington State being the final rats on that sinking ship. There are a number of reasons for all these changes. Just as the players are chasing that NIL money, and a lot of times we're the presidents, or we hear the media, or we hear the coaches saying, well, what in the world are they chasing that money for? Why do those kids want that money? Yeah, the universities are chasing the money too in these conference realignment deals. And on both counts, no one cares about history. No one cares about student athletes. No one cares about tradition. Nobody cares about any of that. You know what they care about? They care about money. And as I always say, when they say they don't care about money is when they especially care about money. That's all this is. This is a big money grab. Do the students matter? Do the players matter? No, of course not. They want money, and they are looking to cash in the biggest way that they can. Hey, when we saw these universities basically having to go out and kind of shop for the best deals for these players, did you really think they were just going to start handing out free money? Of course not. So they're going to bounce around, and they're going to make this basically a semi-pro football league. What it has to do with college, I have no idea. But that's where we are. Right now, it's still called college football. It's basically a semi-pro league, but they still are somehow weirdly affiliated with universities. Anyways, as far as the demise of the Pac-12 conference, hey, let's be real clear. Here at the Dose, we call this a long time ago.
Who from the Pac-12 hurt you?
Oh, way before that even. And you know, there are a few major mistakes that the Pac-12 has made. One, they refused to join ESPN or Fox because they believed they could hold out and form their own network and have the Pac-12 network be as successful as some of the other conferences. Huge mistake. Huge mistake. Because the simple fact is, no one cares that much about the Pac-12. They don't have rabid fans like the SEC and the Big Ten do. So they gambled on themselves and they lost. Second, the Pac-12 conference and its schools failed miserably during COVID. We said it here then. We say it again now. They refused to play despite other bigger conferences jumping back in and not having any issues. The Pac-12 can try to virtue signal and say, hey, we were just doing what was best for the kids. We were just doing what was best for the people in the stands. We were just doing what was best for anyone. No, you weren't. You were trying to make it look like you cared more than anyone else. That's what you were doing. Or you were just blatantly scared. I don't know. Either way, the other conferences jumped back in without health incidents. So I don't want to hear about, well, we were just so concerned about the health. No, you weren't. You were just either scared or you were trying to pretend that you're really, really wonderful people when in fact you're not. Hey, the Pac-12 is dead. And no matter what they do going forward, they can go get San Diego State. They can go get San Jose State. They can go get Boise State. Go get whoever you want. That conference isn't coming back. They made some fatal errors and it is taking that conference to the grave. Hey, like it or not, college sports are headed for super conferences. Will it end up leaving a lot of schools and a lot of kids behind? Yeah, it will. But that is where this all seems to be destined to go. Also, the idea that the schools staying in the Pac-4, whatever they're going to call it, are going to get some sort of easy path to the playoff, that is absolutely ludicrous. The Pac-12 gets left out of the playoff every year already. That will obviously just continue. There's no advantage there. People can try to spin that if they want to, but it's absolutely untrue. They're not going to get into the playoff ever again. They better do it this year in the final year, because after this, they're never getting in again. Finally, we finish off in the National Basketball Association, where the past few weeks have seen some big name players actually staying put with their teams. The Dallas Mavericks re-signed guard Kyrie Irving. Sure, maybe no one else wanted him, but they kept him. Golden State kept forward Draymond Green, who also re-upped, who also may not have been wanted by anyone else. The Milwaukee Bucks kept Chris Middleton. The Charlotte Hornets are keeping LaMelo Ball, and the Portland Trailblazers retain forward Jeremy Grant. Why? I don't know, but they did. And then last week, the Los Angeles Lakers agreed to a reported 3-year contract extension with big man Anthony Davis. They say it is worth up to $186 million. That's insane. I mean, when you stop and you break down the math on that deal, $186 million? That's right around a dollar per injury. But the most head-scratching of all the offseason deals to me was the one a few weeks ago when the Boston Celtics gave Jaylen Brown a 5-year extension worth over $300 million, the biggest contract in NBA history, at least at the time. We know it didn't take long to get passed up. But can anyone please tell me why in the world a professional team would pay a guy that has never done anything clutch in his career? Oh, and also can't dribble with his left hand, the biggest contract in NBA history. I don't understand it. I don't get it. The Celtics have been trying this lineup with Brown and Jason Tatum together for a few years, and they have literally nothing to show for it. They made it to the finals, and then they got taken down. Jaylen Brown is a nice complimentary player, but I don't trust his decisions. I don't trust his dribbling. I certainly don't trust his shooting come playoff time. But hey, the Boston Celtics right now are the definition of insanity. They are trying the same thing, and they are expecting different results. I don't get it, but that's what they're doing. I'll just say this. I would trust Shaquem Griffin's left hand more than I would Jaylen Brown's. But hey, Boston, you do you. We'll see if at the end of this next year, you can go out there and prove me wrong. I kind of doubt it. Okay, coming back. The football season is nearly here. And today on the Daily Dose, we are going to be looking at the teams this year that have the toughest path to success, as well as a few of those teams that should have the easiest. So the football season is coming quickly. Do you realize that we have the first real week of college football in just over 2 weeks? So here at The Dose, we have been getting you ready for the season over the last few weeks. We're going to continue to do that right up until the start of the season. Because, I mean, let's just be real honest here. There are two seasons. Football season and waiting for football season. And then there's just kind of everything else. Well, today on The Dose, we are going to be taking a look at both college football and the NFL, and we're going to examine their schedules. Who has the toughest schedule, at least based on last year's winning percentage? And then who has the easiest? Now, I realize that especially in college, this formula isn't always the best measurement because teams can change so drastically. But it might at least give us some idea of the competition that these teams are going to be facing this season. So right now, here are the five toughest schedules that are going to be in college football this season. At number five, we are going to an SEC team that when it first joined the SEC, this school went on a 23-5 two-year run. They actually played in two straight SEC title games. But man, does that feel like a long time ago for the University of Missouri? Unfortunately, since 2014, the Missouri Tigers have won as many bowl games and generated as many winning seasons in the SEC, well, as I have. And I don't have that many. But you know, the Tigers are in kind of a weird spot. Because it's not that they've been terrible. They have just been in a really bad position of being really average or maybe a little below average. Now, the key this year for the Tigers is going to be, can they find a way to win some close games? Last year, Missouri finished with a 6-7 record. They actually went to a bowl game, shocking, and they lost the Gasparilla Bowl to Wake Forest. But when you think back, four of their losses were by a touchdown or less. Hey, if you win those, and instead of 6-7, you go 10-3, yeah, that's a real different season. But this year, the Tigers are going to face a schedule of opponents with a 61.8% winning percentage. Now, most of those opponents are going to be within the SEC. But check out how their schedule ends this year. Home against LSU, at Kentucky, South Carolina at home, at Georgia, home against Tennessee, and Florida. Good luck, Missouri. You're probably going to need it because that's going to be a really, really tough end to your season. We move up to the fourth toughest schedule in college football this coming season, and we're going to stay in the SEC. Now, this team got out of the gates quickly last year. They rolled to a 7-0 record to start the season. But then the Ole Miss Rebels lost five of their final six games, including the Texas Bowl against Texas Tech. Now, here's a stat of the day that actually might kind of floor you. Over the last three seasons, which SEC program has the third most overall wins behind Alabama and behind Georgia? Yeah, Ole Miss and the Fighting Lane Kiffins. Now, Lane, I know, he's kind of a punk. He talks a lot of nonsense, but Lane is clearly doing something right. And this year, in the offseason, he has gone out and he has hit the transfer portal hard. This team actually has some depth this year. I think Ole Miss can be a little bit of a sneaky contender. Now, will that schedule wear them out? It might. Their out-of-conference schedule is super soft, but they go to Alabama, they go to Auburn, they go to Georgia, and they go to their arch rival, Mississippi State. That's a really tough road slate. We'll see if this team is up to playing that kind of a road schedule, because the Rebels' opponent winning percentage this year going into the season is right about 62%. That's pretty tough. At the third toughest schedule in the country, we go over to the Big 12 and we reach a team that struggled last year. In fact, out of the 14 teams in the Big 12, do you realize there were only two that failed to make it to a bowl game? One was Iowa State and the other was our number three team. Yes, I am referring to those West Virginia Mountaineers. It kind of sounds crazy, but do you realize this will already be Neil Brown's fifth season as head coach? Remember, he took over for Dana Holgorsen back in 2018. That doesn't seem like that long ago, but he's now been on the job going into his fifth year. I guess it's just easy to forget because Neil Brown has been, well, pretty forgettable. He's just 22 and 25 on the job, and the Mountaineers are a team right now. No one's really talking about them in the Big 12, but Neil Brown did go out. He hit the portal hard. And if West Virginia could somehow beef up that running game a little bit, I could actually see them being a little bit competitive this year. They would be able to grind teams down and maybe control the tempo. West Virginia opponents won 62.4% of their games last year. So that's a tough schedule. West Virginia will be opening the season on the road against rival Penn State. So we're going to find out real early how good are the Mountaineers going to be this year. They come in at number three. We reach the team with the second toughest schedule in the country. And for this one, we go over to the Big Ten. You know, after such a promising start in 2021, when they went 11-2, Mel Tucker and the Michigan State Spartans crashed back to earth last season. They went just 5-7. They didn't even get a bowl game. However, let's be honest, that 11-2 record, it was kind of fake. I think we all kind of knew that. But then Tucker got that big contract. But do you realize in his time in East Lansing, Mel Tucker is just over 500. He's 23-21. Now, I don't think he's on the hot seat quite yet, but it might start warming up. And the bad news is that Sparty's opponents going into the season won 62.7% of their games last year. This season, they will host Washington, Michigan, Nebraska, and Penn State, and they will go on the road against Iowa and Minnesota. Hey, that's a pretty rough schedule. Mel Tucker really needs to upgrade that Michigan State defense. Do you realize last year, in every one of their losses, there were seven of them, they allowed more than 27 points per game in each of those losses. Hey, that's tough to overcome, especially up there when a lot of times you're facing bad weather, you're facing wind, you're facing snow. You're telling me I got to go out and I got to score 30 points a game? Yeah, you're going to have a tough time. Mel Tucker has got to get Michigan State off to a good start because, like I said, if not, his seat is going to start warming up and this schedule is not going to be forgiving. You better get off to a good start and you better get rolling because otherwise you're going to get yourself in trouble down the stretch. So we reach the toughest schedule in all of college football this season. And we go back to, big surprise, the SEC, where this team's opponents won a scary 66% of their games last year. And you know, it's kind of funny because this team, they're actually feeling pretty confident. Because of the way they finished last season, they beat both Clemson and Tennessee. Hey, Shane Beamer and the South Carolina Gamecocks went 8-5 last year and they went to the Gator Bowl. Here's the crazy part. South Carolina didn't really play that well last year. I know that sounds crazy, but do you realize South Carolina led the SEC in turnovers? And they were just so erratic. They were so unpredictable from week to week. They might come out and dominate. They might come out and get blown out. You just didn't know. Now, what if this year they actually got quarterback Spencer Rattler to play consistently good football? What if they stop turning the ball over so much? Hey, South Carolina opens the season against rival North Carolina. Then they play that nasty SEC schedule, and then they close out their year with Clemson. Hey, that's a tough schedule. The Gamecocks are going to have to play really, really well. And if they do, I think it's still going to be tough for them to reach the 8 wins that they had last season. That schedule is going to be very, very nasty. Okay, so let's switch over to the other end of things in college football. What about the teams that are playing the soft competition this season? You know, it's always funny to me in college football because every year you'll see a team and they have like a low strength of schedule and they'll talk to the athletic director or they'll talk to the head coach and they'll say, hey, yeah, our schedule is a little soft this year. But I mean, you got to realize we make these schedules years in advance. So we didn't know this team would be down when we planned this. Fair enough. I get it. And yet, when you schedule like Austin Peay in the Citadel, we sort of knew, didn't we? Like, it wasn't that big of a shock. It wasn't like we were saying, you know, come 2023, the Citadel is really going to be rolling. Slow down on that stupid narrative. So right now, let's take a look at the softest schedules in college football. Again, based on what they did last year, which I know that formula isn't foolproof, but it should give us some idea. By the way, on the softest schedules here, I'm not looking at schools outside of the Power 5 conferences. Their conferences totally destroy the strength of schedule, so I'm not going to look there. Let's just look at Big 5 teams. Coming in with the 105th softest schedule in the country is a team that went all the way to the college football playoff last year. Yes, I am talking about those Texas Christian Horned Frogs. Now we know, Sonny Dykes' team was absolutely taken to the woodshed in the title game against Georgia. But hey, the Horned Frogs did manage to beat Michigan in the semifinal. They did play for that title. The problem for TCU, they had 8 players drafted into the NFL. And while Dykes may have done a good job recruiting, and in the transfer portal, that's still going to be a lot to overcome. Fortunately for TCU, they get early games against Colorado and against Nicholls State. Well, you should be able to get off to a strong start, shouldn't you? TCU opponents won just 48.7% of their games last season, and that should help cushion the fall for TCU after losing so many talented players. Next up, with the 106th softest schedule, is a team that is just trying to get back on track after years of mediocrity. Matt Rhule did a great job of making Temple respectable and making Baylor a contender. Then he went to the NFL. Then he limped out with his tail between his legs. Well, the Nebraska Cornhuskers believe that Matt Rhule is the guy to restore the greatness in Lincoln. Nebraska went just 4-8 last year. They fired Scott Frost after he failed to win games. And honestly, it wasn't even that they lost. It was that Scott Frost seemed to specialize in like creative ways to lose games at the end. Well, Matt Rhule is going to really have to upgrade Nebraska's ability to stop the run before he does anything else. Because right now, teams can go into Nebraska and they can just dominate them up front. They can push them around. They can run the ball down their throat. It is tough to win games when you can't stop the run. Now, I would think Matt Rhule will get a little help from this schedule because the Nebraska Cornhuskers open with Minnesota, but then they get 3 straight weeks of below average teams. They face Colorado, they face Northern Illinois, and they face Louisiana Tech. Hey, if you can't win those games, good luck, because the Big Ten schedule will be a little bit tougher. The Huskers' opponent win percentage is just 48.4%. So we slide down to our 3rd softest schedule, and at the 109th softest schedule, we stay in the Big Ten, where the Iowa Hawkeyes went 8-5 last year, despite setting back offensive football to like the 1800s. Head coach Kirk Ferentz, he took some heat when he hired his son Brian to be the Hawkeyes' offensive coordinator. Well, then Brian's offense averages 17 points a game, and I don't know, they couldn't score on a drunk Kardashian. And yet, Iowa did manage to make a bowl game. Now, what if they actually improved that offense this season? Well, when their opponent's win percentage is 47.7%, I think Iowa might be primed to be a little bit of a sneaky team this year. They face Utah State. They face Western Michigan. And then they have the Big Ten schedule, but they don't have to play Ohio State or Michigan. I'm not saying they're going to deserve it, but the Iowa Hawkeyes might win some games this year. They might be a sneaky team to watch. So we arrive next at our second softest schedule with a 46.6 winning percentage, which ranks them 113th in the country. And this belongs to a team in the Pac-12. Because the Washington State Cougars went 7-6 last year. They went to the Jimmy Kimmel Bowl, whatever that is. Well, the Cougars need to finish stronger. Last year, they were outscored significantly in the fourth quarter. You want to win games? Finish in the fourth quarter. Cougars didn't always do that. But this schedule does lend itself to improvement. They come to Colorado State. They host Northern Colorado, Colorado, Arizona, and Stanford this year. Hey, honestly, that should be 5 easy wins, and Washington State shouldn't even have to break a sweat. Then they have a road game at Cal, which honestly, Cal Berkeley should just drop sports at this point. Now, I'm not sure the Cougars are going to be great this year, but they might have a respectable record just because they play such a soft schedule. They come in at number 2 on our list with the 113th softest schedule in the country. So we reach the softest schedule among Big 5 teams with a winning percentage of just 46.2%. And we go to the ACC where the Louisville Cardinals went 8-5 under Scott Satterfield last year. Then he bolted for the Cincinnati job, and Cardinal fans got what they were hoping for, because they went out and signed new head coach Jeff Brohm, who, of course, had some great seasons for Louisville. They wanted him all along. Now, Brohm somehow won more games than he lost at Purdue. I have no idea how, because Purdue is not an easy place to win in football. But Brohm has a chance to get his tenure off at Louisville with a real strong start, because this schedule is toilet paper soft. The Cardinals face Murray State, Indiana. They do finish with Kentucky outside their conference schedule, but within the ACC, they don't play Clemson, they won't play Florida State, and they won't play North Carolina. Louisville might have a pretty good record this year, and yet it might be a little bit fake. The Louisville schedule ranks 115th in the country. A couple of other teams that did just miss our list, they are also playing some pretty soft schedules. The USC Trojans, their schedule is ranked 98. Oregon is ranked 97. Penn State is number 90. Florida State is 78. And the University of Georgia is number 63. Hey, don't be surprised when a few of these teams we just talked about have very strong records, because they absolutely should with these very soft schedules. But let's switch over to the NFL, where we have a little bit of an easier time predicting the strength of schedule based on last year's record, because teams don't change that much every single year in the NFL. And yet, how many times do we see a team in the NFL with zero expectations surprise everyone and then make the playoffs? Well, did they suddenly just get really good? I mean, sometimes. But a lot of times the schedule plays a big part in it. So first off, let's take a look at the toughest schedules this year in the NFL. So we actually have 3 teams tied with an identical opponent winning percentage of 54.9%. And the first of those teams is the Dallas Cowboys. Now, the Cowboys went 12-5 last year. They made it all the way to the divisional round of the playoffs, where they were beaten by the San Francisco 49ers. You might remember head coach Mike McCarthy decided to play running back Ezekiel Elliott at center on the final play of the game. It was an odd end to a better than expected season, I think. But the Cowboys will be facing the AFC East this season, and that won't be easy. Now, I do think Zeke's best days were behind him, so he's gone. But the Cowboys now have Troy Pollard at running back, and they don't have much behind him. Dak Prescott and Mike McCarthy need to have a real strong showing this year, and the schedule is not going to be easy. They are tied on this list today at third. Also tied at number three are the New England Patriots. You know, Bill Belichick and Tom Brady, they benefited for years with a really soft division. But that is no longer the case. Belichick is going to have his work cut out for him facing a really tough division. And then they will also have to face the NFC East. And they will have to do it with quarterback Mac Jones. Now, as usual, the Patriots should have a very good defense under Belichick. But, you know, last year the Patriots' offense averaged just 21 points a game, which ranked them 21st out of 32 teams. I expect the Patriots to be scrappy this year, and yet I still kind of expect them to finish dead last in the division because the schedule won't be easy. The Patriots are also tied at number three. Our final team with that same opponent winning percentage of 54.9% belongs to the New York Giants, who are starting to feel pretty good about themselves. Led by head coach Brian Daboll, quarterback Daniel Jones showed some improvement last year. The offense became more consistent. The Giants finished 9-7-1. They won a playoff game. They made it to the divisional round last year. Now, can Daniel Jones continue to improve? I don't know. The Giants did pick up tight end Darren Waller. If he could stay healthy, that would help. And they might need that help because I don't like their wide receivers at all. I like the Giants a little bit, but I could see this tough schedule wearing them out, and I could actually see the Giants regressing just a little bit from last year. Okay, so we move to the second toughest schedule in the NFL, and we get to a team that is going to be so tough to predict this year because the Miami Dolphins went 9-8 last year. They lost their wild card playoff game to the Buffalo Bills. But how do you predict what this team is going to do when Tua Tagovailoa is under center? If he plays and he's healthy, the Dolphins, honestly, they could be a sneaky contender. But does anyone really believe that Tua is capable of playing 17 plus games? I know I don't. And the Dolphins don't really have any depth behind him. So if he goes down, no, they're going to be in big trouble. So right now, the Miami Dolphins have all their chips in the basket of a player who, when asked on the field after he was flung to the turf what his name was last year, he answered October. Yeah, that might not be that dependable. That's going to be tough. This schedule is tough. The opponent winning percentage that Miami is going to face this year is 55.4%. The Dolphins aren't going to get many easy weeks. That makes me a little bit concerned about them. So we reach the toughest schedule in the NFL this year, at least prior to the season. We know that can change. And with an opponent winning percentage of 56.6%, that's pretty steep. That goes to the defending NFC champion, Philadelphia Eagles. Now remember, the Eagles were this close to winning the Super Bowl last year. They had that game locked up, and then they let the Kansas City Chiefs come back and beat them at the end. Here is my concern for the Eagles this year. Teams that lose the Super Bowl rarely bounce back stronger the following season. You can count the number of times that has happened on one hand. Hey, the Eagles had a solid offseason, but they do have to replace some key members on that defense. And also, remember, they had some pretty good injury luck last year. Well, this brutal schedule isn't going to help that. If the Eagles go back to the Super Bowl this year, make no mistake, they will have earned it. Okay, coming back, we have to get over to the softest schedules in the NFL this year. And then we need to get over to our Daily Dose top five. If I were to ask you right now, who are the best teams year in, year out in college football, what would your answer be? Our Daily Dose Top 5 might surprise you at least a little bit. So let's finish up our football schedule preview in the NFL, where we are now moving on to the softest schedules in the league this season based on last year's winning percentage of their opponents. And we start off at number 28 with a team that really needs to bounce back this year. Because after they started the season 7-3 last year, the Tennessee Titans lost 7 straight games to finish the season. They completely missed the postseason. Then, this offseason, they shot both quarterback Ryan Tannehill and running back Derrick Henry. And then when no one was interested, they brought them both back and they signed wide receiver DeAndre Hopkins. Does anyone have any idea what is going on with Tennessee? Because honestly, I don't. Their soft schedule, 44.8%, it should help. But hey, if the Titans face adversity this season, we could see them melt down. Because this all feels really tenuous. And I could easily see guys start to check out and say, hey, we're getting ready to rebuild. This is it for this era. We might be done. And things could go really, really bad for Tennessee, despite having a very soft schedule. We slide down to the 29th softest schedule at 43.4%. And we get to another team that is in kind of a weird spot. Because the Indianapolis Colts have tried to plug in veteran quarterbacks Phillip Rivers and Matt Ryan to see if either could kind of rally the troops and maybe make a run at a playoff. Well, both failed miserably. So they signed veteran quarterback Gardner Minshew, but then they drafted talented Florida quarterback Anthony Richardson. Now, AR is an athletic freak. The problem is that I don't believe he's going to be ready for this level of football anytime soon. Add into the equation the fact that running back Jonathan Taylor isn't happy with the team, and you kind of have the formula for what could end up being a bit of a mess. But hey, at least the Colts get to play a very soft schedule, and that could help things from completely melting down this year. I think they might be challenged. I don't think they should be a complete disaster. At number 30, we have the Houston Texans, who are also trying to rebuild their roster after going just 3-13-1 last year. New head coach DeMeco Ryans, hey, dude's going to have his hands full. He's got to try to figure out whether or not to go with rookie quarterback C.J. Stroud and risk breaking him, or stick with the veteran Davis Mills, despite the fact the fans won't want to see that. Now, I do think Houston should be improved from last season, and playing against opponents with a combined winning percentage of 43.1%, yeah, that should help. But this is still a bad football team, and they have a long way to go before they can actually do anything. This defense is bad too. Ryans needs all the help he can get. So at number 31, with a 42.7 opponent winning percentage, we have a team that could really take advantage of a soft schedule. And that is the New Orleans Saints. Now, the Saints were 7-10 last season. And then this offseason, they went out and they signed quarterback Derek Carr to try to jumpstart that offense. Will it work? I don't know. But honestly, can he really be any worse than Andy Dalton? Probably not. Now, will running back Alvin Kamara do anything when he returns from a suspension? Because he had some off-the-field foolishness going in Las Vegas. I don't know. Could the defense improve? That would help. Will wide receiver Michael Thomas ever stop hating football and actually participate in a real-life game? Doubtful at best. But if any of those things happen, yeah, the Saints could be one of those teams that surprises everyone by rallying to the playoffs. And a lot of it will be because they have that soft schedule. So we finish off with the softest schedule in the NFL this coming season. And that will belong to the Saints' rival, the Atlanta Falcons, who are also hoping to make a playoff run since they are going to be facing teams with a combined 41.7 winning percentage. That's not real strong. Now, the Falcons gave up last year on quarterback Marcus Mariota. Well, and then he gave up on them or something. I don't know. Now, they're going to go with second-year quarterback Desmond Ridder at quarterback and hope that rookie running back Bijan Robinson might be able to carry this team. I think the tough part for this team is that their defense is so bad. But if Ritter and Robinson can move the chains, I mean, maybe Atlanta could dominate time of possession. Maybe they could steal a few wins. And this division, the NFC South, is going to be pretty bad. The Falcons might be a playoff team. Are they really that good? No, but playing this week's schedule could really, really help. Hey, again, we see it every year. There are teams that make a run to the postseason. Is it because they really figured things out? No. It's because their schedule allowed for it. And a couple of these teams on our list this week of soft schedules, you might want to keep them in the back of your mind. They might be a little bit sneaky to watch. Now, as we do so many weeks here at the Daily Dose, we need to get to our Daily Dose Top 5. Okay, so it is now 2023. We are nearly a quarter of a century into the 2000s. And if I asked you right now, who are the best college football programs in the country? What would your answer be? Keep in mind how much college football has changed since the year 2000. I mean, that was back in the BCS days. The year 2000, in fact, featured the Oklahoma Sooners beating the Florida State Seminoles and Heisman winner Chris Winkie in the Orange Bowl to win the national championship. So Oklahoma finished 1, Florida State fell to 5, and in the final rankings, at 2 was Miami, 3 was Washington, and 4 was Oregon State. Virginia Tech was 6, Nebraska was 8. Now, 22 years later, who are the best teams in college football over the past nearly quarter century? Today, our Daily Dose Top 5 counts down the top 5 college football programs in the 2000s by winning percentage. And I'm telling you right now, there are a couple of teams on here that might surprise you a little bit. We start off at number 5. And if you're going to sustain winning, then it helps to have some really good head coaches. Well, this program at number 5 started off the 2000s with a head coach by the name of Nick Saban. Yeah, Nicky did a pretty good job. And then in 2003, he led the Louisiana State Tigers to a national championship. When Nick left for Tuscaloosa, Les Miles was named the head coach. He did pretty well too. Miles went 114-34 with LSU. He won a title in 2007. But then he would be fired in 2016, and they handed the program over to a wild man by the name of Ed Orgeron. No one expected that much. But the Tigers were stocked with talent. And in 2019, the LSU Tigers finished the season 15-0. They may have been the most dominating national title team ever. But think of some of the talent that has come out of LSU in the 2000s. Joe Burrow, Ja'Marr Chase, Derek Stingley Jr., Devin White, Leonard Fournette, Tyrann Mathieu, Patrick Peterson. The LSU Tigers come in today at number 5 with a winning percentage of 74.8%. Next up at number 4 might be the team that you might expect to be on top. I mean, they have now won back-to-back national titles, but the Georgia Bulldogs had a few leaner seasons, let's say, under Mark Richt at the beginning of the century. The Bulldogs replaced Richt after the 2015 season, and new head coach Kirby Smart has never looked back. Of course, Smart was a Saban disciple, and Kirby Smart is now 81-15. He has 3 national championships, and honestly, it might not end anytime soon. The Georgia Bulldogs are now 235-70 in the 2000s. They have 3 championships. Their winning percentage is 77%. And look at the talent that has come out of Athens. Jalen Carter, Jordan Davis, Roquan Smith, Thomas Davis, Christopher Smith. The Georgia Bulldogs have been so good, but they come in today on our list at number 4. Okay, so if Georgia isn't number 1, then it must be this team. But people do tend to forget that the Alabama Crimson Tide actually started the 2000s with Dennis Franchione and then Mike Shula at head coach. Those were some rough times. But of course, then the tide went out. They got Nick Saban, and the rest, as they say, is history. Saban won national championships in 2009, 2011, 2012, 2015, 2017, and 2020. Yeah, six times. They have played for the title nine different times. And again, when you're talking about NFL talent, Alabama just has so much. Bryce Young, Najee Harris, Devontae Smith, Patrick Surtain II, Minka Fitzpatrick, Derrick Henry, Amari Cooper, Dante Hightower, Mark Ingram. There are literally too many great players to list here. The Alabama Crimson Tide have won 78% of their games in the 2000s. And that comes in at number three. So we reached the number two team on our list of top college football programs of the 2000s. And we reached a team that has managed to stay reasonably consistent in this century. Well, at least until last year. But the Oklahoma Sooners have gone 245-60 in this century. And yet they have won just a single national title in this era. The Sooners started the century by winning that title, like we talked about, over Florida State with head coach Bob Stoops and a really good defense. But Stoops would announce his retirement after the 2016 season, and offensive coordinator Lincoln Riley would take over. But the Sooners didn't really miss a beat. Riley went 55-10 as the head coach at Norman. He produced two Heisman Trophy quarterbacks in Baker Mayfield and Kyler Murray. He almost got another one in Jalen Hurts. And sure, they haven't had the national championships that some of the other teams have had on this list, but Oklahoma has been consistently winning games every single year. And again, their rosters are consistently filled with NFL talent. CeeDee Lamb, DD Westbrook, Sam Bradford, Adrian Peterson. The Oklahoma Sooners have been highly successful in this century. They have been so consistent, and they come in today at number two with an 80.3 winning percentage. So we arrive at the top team of the 2000s by winning percentage, and we reach a program that has gone an amazing 246-48 so far this century. That is nearly an 84% winning percentage. They have played for five national championships in that time, and they have won two titles. But as far as consistency in winning, no one is doing it better than the Ohio State Buckeyes. They started the century under John Cooper. He was gone in 2001. And then Jim Tressel came on, and he began a pretty amazing run. Tressel went 106-22 in Columbus, and in 2002, he did win a national championship. But then came crazy Urban Meyer. Urban had quite the record in Columbus. Dude went an amazing 83-9 with the Buckeyes. He won a title in 2014. Then Meyer retired again, and on came Ryan Day, who also has a great record. Day has gone 45-6, but he still is chasing a national title. And again, the Buckeyes have a ton of talent that they have produced. Chase Young, Denzel Ward, Joey Bosa, Malcolm Jenkins, Troy Smith, AJ Hawk. The Ohio State Buckeyes are the winningest college football program of the 2000s with an 83.7 winning percentage. Did you say Ohio State when the question was first posed? I know I didn't. There were some other teams I thought of first. For the record, just missing the cut, we had Clemson at number six. We had Oregon at number seven. USC came in at number eight. And then the surprise for me, Texas Christian at number nine. I didn't realize that. And the Wisconsin Badgers finish out the top 10. Is that who you had when you made that list in your head? I know I didn't. But isn't it interesting that all 10 of those teams are once again at least going to be in the conversation this coming season? Because they seem to be doing it better than anyone else in the country, at least right now. Hey, next week on The Dose, we are trying to line up a few things, but you know, We're going to continue ramping up for the coming football season. And of course, we will be bringing you the latest in sports news as only we can. So make sure you tune into the Daily Dose and be sure you let a friend know to do the same. And I want to say thank you to each and every one of you for listening to the Daily Dose every week. Thank you for the emails. Thank you for the texts. Thank you for the tweets. Thank you for going over to DailyDoseSports.com and checking out the new things going up there every week. But more than anything, thank you for sharing the show, for sharing the videos, for sharing the articles with someone that you know. We absolutely love it when you do that. Have to say thank you to JSP. Could not do any of this without you. I will see you all next Wednesday. Have a great week, everybody.
Who from the Pac-12 hurt you?